If you walked in over the last few minutes, we are in Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3, we are starting a new series of sermons today called Your Prayer Has Been Heard. And during this series of sermons, we're going to speak of really the cry or prayers that had been offered, not just by our generation, not just by those who live now, but by people going back all the way to Adam and Eve for exactly what transpired during that advent when Jesus came and entered our world. And if you're unfamiliar with the word advent, if that's a new word for you, we often use it interchangeably with the Christmas times. It's not really exactly interchangeable, but for our sake, it'll probably be interchangeable. It is actually a word that means come towards or to come to. And so we celebrate Advent, for it is the time where God came to us, came towards us, specifically in the person and work of Jesus. And so Advent is the celebration that Jesus came. And so that's why it is very significant for us to celebrate it well. Furthermore, it is significant in a way that it answers the trouble humanity got itself into going all the way back to Genesis chapter 3. In fact, Genesis chapter 3, and the reason we're starting there is because that gives us the answer as to why Advent is significant, why it is important, why it is crucial, and why it should be something that we celebrate, not just during the quote-unquote Advent season, but continuously. And so Genesis 3 also paints a state of this world. As we read Genesis 3, we see in God's proclamation of his judgments, as many people understand it, in this description of the fall of mankind and the curse of the world that we live in, we see an amazing picture, amazing descriptive, correct description of our current world. But also within those verses, we see God's plan of response to the state of the world. And one more thing to mention about Genesis 1 through 3, it's in one sense it's a very impersonal tale of Adam and Eve. These were real people. They actually existed. We're not given too much of an information as far as their history, as to how they reacted completely to these events, their emotional state, all the things that we think of when we think about the totality of a human being and how they react to really a devastating watershed moment in human history. But even though we do get something of a sketch of their life, we're not really meant to get too personal a sketch, because the story is not just Adam and Eve's story, it's our story. And that's why it's not so personal to them, because we are meant to read this. And the very first readers of this, who were the Israelites coming out of the Exodus from Egypt, they were meant to read this as their story. This is how we got to where we are now, having been delivered by God from the hands of the Egyptians. And so this is our story. This story is meant to tell us about Adam and Eve in their roles as representatives of humanity. In fact, the rest of the Bible seems to follow Genesis's lead on this and does the exact same thing with Adam and Eve. In Romans chapter 5, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, we see examples of the Bible stating that Adam and Eve were our representatives for humanity. And so we know the Bible is very consistent on this, on what Adam and Eve, who they were, and what they represented for human beings. And this is a very important passage to read, because these are God's first statements to sinners. God's first statements to sinners. The first sinners and his first statement to sinners. And what he says is pretty revealing. And so revealing, in fact, that it should inform the nature of our prayers, the kind of prayers that we can reflect on during Advent and say, our prayers have been heard. Our prayers have been heard. They also give us the prayers that we should be praying. They inform the prayers we are to be making. Okay, so let's get started. Look at Genesis chapter 3. We're not going to go over the first portion where the husband and the wife are tempted by the serpent, where they fall into sin, where they choose their way over God's way. They choose to give in to the temptation and the lies that the serpent told over the truth that God had already proclaimed to them. And it says that once they had done that, verse 7, the eyes of both of them were opened. The eyes of both of them were opened. And they knew that they were naked. They were suddenly aware of their nakedness, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths. So along with being aware that they were naked, they were ashamed of their nakedness, and so they sewed loincloths and began the process of hiding. Now, this is probably literally true for them, but it was also figuratively true, meaning this was the beginning of humanity's attempts to hide from his own sinfulness and to hide from God, and then eventually to post blame to other things or other people, as we're going to see in the subsequent verses. Look at verse 8. And they heard the sound of the Lord walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. But the Lord God called to the man and said to him, "Where are you? Where are you?" And it's not that he actually had lost the man. He wants the man to realize that he is hidden from the Lord, the one who is supposedly he is to be in good relationship with. But of course, that's the point. His relationship has now gone askew. And so he says, where are you? And he said, "I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and so I hid myself." And the Lord said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat?" Now, of course, again, God is not unaware that they have done just that, but he is asking, does the man understand what he has done? Is he ready to confess what he has done? He has done exactly as the Lord has told him not to. He says, "Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you not to eat?" Verse 12. The man said what? "Yes, I have." No. He says, the woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me the fruit of the tree and I ate. And so passing the buck begins, right? Here we go. Then it continues on. What is this that you have done?" the Lord said to the woman. And the woman said, "It is the serpent who deceived me. It was your creation. It was the world you put us in. It was this garden that you stuck us in with a snake. He is the reason why I did this. The serpent deceived me and I ate." And the Lord God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and above all beasts of the field. On your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life." Now, real quickly, I just want to mention something. A lot of people have fanciful ideas of snakes having legs or wings, and that they were basically chopped off as a result of this, and they became a slithering creature. That is probably not the point of what it's getting at. It's not trying to tell us that they look different at one time. This is a description of probably what they already did, but he's describing it in such a way that the serpent knows he is in subjugation, that he is in an unfavorable position, that he is essentially defeated. He is living forward as a defeated one. Verse 15, "I will put enmity," or hostility is another way of saying that, "between you," he's talking to the serpent still, "between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." Now to the woman he said, "I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children, and your desire shall be for your husband, or your desire shall be in conflict with, or basically competing with your husband, and he shall rule over you." It says one of those, we're not really sure which, but he shall rule over you. And to Adam he said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all of the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field, and by the sweat of the face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return." And the man called his wife's name Eve, because she was the mother of all the living. I'm just going to stop there, because that verse is meant to jump off the page and catch us off guard and to serve notice that something is happening here that we may have missed. And the reason I say that is this. There has been a judgment just proclaimed to the man and to the woman. And upon coming out of this judgment, now wait a minute. Remember how Adam mentally went into the judgment. Adam mentally went into the judgment believing the woman you put me with, she's the reason I'm in this predicament. He went into the judgment blaming her and seeing it ultimately as God's fault for giving him to her. And he comes out of the judgment saying, "You are Eve. You're the giver of life." What a change of heart. What a change. In fact, we would call this Adam's belief, his seed of a belief in the gospel of Christ. This is him taking at faith God's word to him in this moment. His word that he will redeem his people. You may say, how does he get there? How does he even get to this point? Well, we know that that is one of only two possible reactions you would have to these verses. In fact, Adam and Eve's children, his first children, Cain and Abel, represent two separate reactions to these verses. I don't want to spend much time with it, but it might help us just to read a bit of this story. In chapter 4, Cain and Abel are born, and it says in verse 2, Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a worker of the ground. And in the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. Now, real quickly, there is nothing in the text that tells us why this is the case. There's nothing in the text. Some try to make something of the fact that one gave of the animal herd and one gave of the grain and one was better than the other. That is actually an intellectually dishonest way of approaching this because both are potentially very good offerings, okay? So we know that nothing in this text really tells us. So God is not interested in giving us the details of why he had regard for one or why he did not have regard for the other, but we must make the conclusion that one was following in the ways of his father, Adam. Abel was following in his father's steps, having faith in God, giving his sacrifice in faith and belief of hope that what God has said, apparently in these verses, the good things he said, is true. Yet we have that in contrast with Cain. He is believing a different father. A father that the Bible will eventually call a father of lies. A father who would tell him, that would convince him, that the grave consequences of God's proclamation in chapter 3 is in fact all we have to look forward to. And so he did not offer his offering in faith at all. Or maybe we could say in a different kind of faith. Faith that God is, in fact, what Satan tried to make him out to be, not as good as he looks at first appearance. Okay? So, having said this, and read Genesis 4 to give you a little background, let's think about the response of Cain and what he was given to. Apparently, whatever he was given to, he was at least given to despair and cynicism. See, when you do not offer offering in hope and faith, which that is the kind of offering that God had regard for, one of hope and faith that God would deliver. When you instead do it with despair and cynicism, it will affect the way you respond to the proclamations that God makes in chapter 3. So let's look at the response of Cain, one that's given to cynicism and despair, because there are very real consequences in this passage. And when we respond to those consequences in ways that are unhealthy, we are given to cynicism and despair. First, we are told that we are going to live in a world where the enemy, the serpent, is going to target the progeny or the offspring of the woman. She will target them. And there's going to be enmity. There's going to be strife. There's going to be hostility. The narrative of our lives. This passage is teaching us that the narrative of our lives, of human beings' lives, will be set against the background of a spiritual war. There will always be the tune of spiritual war playing underneath the stuff of life. It always exists. A war where we often see and feel the effects of that enmity or hostility. Surely, just in the last week, maybe even the last 24 hours, we have felt, we have seen with our own eyes the effects of hostility in this world. Just the culture of hostility, the culture of enmity, the spiritual war underneath it all. And the serpent is going to target God's people or target God's progeny and then target other human beings to leverage or use for his purposes. We see this. We see this in human beings from a very early age. Children put us on notice that even though we did not teach them to bowl up maybe, or we didn't teach them to be stubborn, we didn't teach them to say no when we tell them yes, we know that there are other voices that they're listening to. That there are voices both coming from within themselves, coming from the sin that they were born into, but also the voices from the spiritually dark places of the enemy of our souls. And he has targeted our literal children. And he begins getting them up to speed on what it looks like to live in a world of consequences to the fall. And gets them to interact with those consequences in a very fleshly, very Cain-like way. And so they learn to do this. And you know, we're despairing cynics, you and I, when we join the ranks of the enemy. I mean, it says right there, it says that it will, he will leverage not only his own means, but he will have a people of his own. He will have an offspring of his own that subscribe to his lies, that will join him with him in his anti-truth campaign, in his campaign to destroy all that is good, in his campaign to sully the hearts of men and women. And we are despairing cynics when we join with that rank. Sometimes it's easy to note who we believe are those who are joined with God's rank, with the enemy's rank, because they're the ones who are obviously fighting against good, obviously fighting against God, obviously trying to discredit anything of a spiritual nature. I don't really want to talk about them today because it's kind of an easy target. I'm not trying to say it doesn't exist. Of course it exists. Evil exists in the world. This is the most obvious ways we can see evil existing in the world. I want to talk to you, though, about the more subtle ways it exists in our world, how it exists even amongst Christians who temporarily will jump sidelines and join Team Satan for a time. It's when they say things like this that sound profoundly spiritual, clever, or maybe even wise, but are profoundly evil. When they say, I love Jesus, I just hate his church. You have joined the ranks of the enemy in that moment. He's using you and leveraging you. I can spend time with Jesus. I just don't want to spend time with Jesus' people. Again, you are subtly just working yourself over to the other sideline in that moment. That is a cynical response, a despairing response, really, to the consequences of living in a wartime reality. Now, we'll get to the underlying good news here in a moment, but I want to keep going on these consequences, the ways of Cain, because not only do we see that spiritual war is the undercurrent of the world we live in, but human relationships will be a source of much pain and conflict. We see that when he speaks of the fact that childbearing, and when it says childbearing, it's not just talking about the act of giving birth to a child. It's talking about childbearing in a sense of where it begins all the way to its completion of your parenting that child, okay? Which if we're to believe the Bible, really never ends until we end up dead ourselves. And so it's talking about the whole raising of a child, the holistic raising of a child. There's much pain, anguish, anxiety in it. Not only that, not only are you going to have pain, anguish, and anxiety with children, with your progeny, but you are also going to have discord with your spouse. And he speaks specifically to Adam and Eve in this sense. He says that she will actually come in conflict with her husband, and he will rule over her. Now, whatever you make of those passages, I don't think there was much to be made of as far as drawing too much out of it, except for this, that there is a disjointedness and a conflict that is inherent in the condition of humanity when we engage one with another. And it's not just male and female, it's not just husband and wife, it's human and human. We are disjointed and always at odds with one another. And so we know that we are living in the ways of Cain when we almost just accept that as the way it is, and we just decide that we're going to do our best to make it. And what is meant to be one flesh, what is called one flesh, just a chapter before, is now out of sync. The picture is one of relational pain and disharmony. The last 2 weeks, we've seen a lot of disharmony and relational contention, have we not? We had an election, and there was a lot to be said afterwards. In my estimation, too much that was said afterwards. Way too much. And we were simply lead foot. Those of us who engage in this, we were leading with cynicism and despair by entering Cain's way of playing to the consequences. We joined in and we decided we're going to try and fight for getting on top or fight for superiority of our candidate or our particular argument or our policy. And then not long after the election came Thanksgiving dinner, where many of you with your family, and some of you have a great time with your family, and there's no sense of disharmony, and that's a grace. Some of you can't say that. It's uncomfortable. It's tense. And the fact that there was election 2 weeks before made it even worse for some of your families, right? We don't have to go far to see the truthfulness of this working itself out in this world. The question isn't whether it's a truthful identification of how things operate in this world. The question is, will we embrace it to the degree or see it to the degree that we will despair and become cynics over it like Cain? Some of you have joined in to the game that Cain plays. You're despairing, and we recognize you're despairing by way of handling relationships that are already fractured by manipulating them, by trying to position yourself as superior to someone who you see as your enemy. You begin having judgment on others. You begin shaming others. Those of you who are Cowboys fans, I imagine many of you who are Cowboys fans have just dreaded that one Uncle Clyde or whatever his name is or whatever her name is that comes every year and wants to remind you the futility of being a Cowboys fan. They want to tell you about how Jerry Jones will always inhibit you guys from ever doing anything of note. This Thanksgiving, you were positioned to basically puff your chest out and say, Dak Prescott, you know, enough said. You know, you were positioned to actually handle that guy, whereas you dreaded it years past. But you're ready this year, right? That's a comical way of doing it, but this is what we do. We position ourselves to be in the superior seat in whatever we do. The way we do this on Facebook is shameful. The way we rant or the way we position ourselves as somehow superior to others or shame others. If you went shaming others for going Black Friday shopping, shame on you. If you went Black Friday shaming to just stick it to those who don't want you to be Black Friday shopping, shame on you. So funny. These are things we don't always agree with. Some say Black Friday shopping's good. Truth is, Bible doesn't talk about it at all. At all. Okay? In fact, if we were to say anything, it says some days are special to others, some days are not special to others. Let all do what is good in their conscience about those things. And don't impose your conscience on others in those questionable matters. Okay, so we have a way of positioning ourselves in a lot of ways in today's world to make ourselves out to be the good guys and others the bad guys. That's the game of Cain, a despairing cynic. Finally, we see here that the created order will be a reminder of sin's effects. It will be a reminder of sin's effects. Thistles and thorns will be the result of your hard labor, or you will have to labor hard amongst thistles and thorns. You will have sweat on your brow. It will take a lot of effort for you to enjoy the fruit of your efforts in food. And so we see this struggle between man and dominion over the creation, something that he was meant to do. He was meant to have dominion over creation. We know that as early as Genesis chapter 1. That was part of man imaging his creator in the creation. But yet now we know it's going to be a struggle. It's going to be hard, that there are going to be barriers, impediments. And we're going to run into problems even in our own tiny front yards and backyards where we cannot hold them in dominion. Work will be difficult. The same dirt from which we were given life, this passage tells us, will be the same that eventually claims our life. We will go back to the ground. The picture painted here is one of difficulty and striving in a physical realm that is broken, folks. Physical realm that's broken. Again, this is true. This is just true. And we feel this. We feel this through our inability to harness the full potential of nature, or we see its outright rejection of our attempts to make something of it, or by our anxieties over our pending deaths, especially those midlife anxieties, realizing it's half over, the show's half over, the curtain's closing on your life, and it's just a matter of time. We start thinking about death and beginning to despair over it and become cynics. And so we can go the way of Cain, the way of Cain in responding to all this, not the fact that it's true, but embracing it as the ultimate truth, the ultimate thing that we need to respond to, and we despair and we become cynical when we choose ways to get around the brokenness of this world. We do this by being lazy. It's a broken world. It's got to get anything you get by the sweat of your brow, so we just choose laziness. A false sense of comfort. We choose to steal. We choose to cheat. These are all end-arounds. These are ways that we respond to the truth of living in a broken world. We find ways to get ourselves on top. Cynicism and despair always produces bad fruit. The way of Cain always produces bad fruit. It produces a sufficiency on our part to find ways to get around the consequences of sin in a world, a way to profit, a way to somehow wind up on top. We may all be losers in this world, but I want to be the chief loser, meaning I want to be on top of all the other losers. That's where I want to finish. Then there was the way of Cain. There was the way of Abel. And the way of Abel was following in the footsteps of his father Adam, who with faith took what God said as a proclamation of judgment, but read between the lines, heard things that Cain did not hear, and responded in hope and in faith, and said, "You are Eve, my wife. You're the life giver. You will give life because you represent God who I hope in, a God I put my faith in who will bring life out of death." So let's look at the way of Abel, hope and faith. And by the way, the way of hope and faith has got to recognize, even within a proclamation of judgment of the fall, lies some common graces along the way. Some graces that we all, not just Christians, but all human beings, will get to live with. Now there's something wholly unique and different about what a Christian can expect. But let's just start with these common graces. First of all, you notice that he says, even though that there's going to be enmity and war and strife between the serpent and the woman and their offspring, he says the woman's offspring will keep the offspring of the enemy at bay. He will keep him at bay. And notice, this is interesting, notice when it uses the language of bruising the heel, it's not bruising the heel of the offspring, but bruising the heel of the serpent. And so the Lord intends, through his people and ultimately through his person, Jesus, through his Redeemer, Jesus, he intends to crush the serpent. Romans tells us this very clearly, that this is what this verse was talking about or referring to or trying to project forward or prophesy forward about, that the heel of Jesus would crush the serpent. It is important to note that the heel is not crushing the serpent's followers. Why is that important? Because they are still people of which we will have hope in. They may be on Team Satan, Team Serpent now. But this tells me a gospel truth, that there's hope for them. There's hope for him. That they don't have to meet the same fate of the crushed head of the serpent. Now, they will meet the same fate should they reject Jesus. But, even above all that, in this world, we know that evil is held at bay, that we, as the progeny of Eve, as the offspring of Eve, we play a very significant role, both through our individual efforts and through government and through other institutions in our world, to hold at bay evil from its full potential. And we're told that that is a part of what's going to happen despite the consequences, that the children of Eve will always hold at bay evil, will always bruise him and keep him from winning. In fact, he isn't a winner at all. He is a defeated one, being defeated as we make war with him. Then it also tells us that we are still able to be fruitful and multiply. Multiplying pain and childbearing, and then ultimately also to have conflict with her husband. So there's going to be conflict in humanity. There's going to be trouble with raising a new generation in humanity. But here's the good news. You still get to have children. You still get to have a progeny. You still get to marry and give in marriage. And you still get to cooperate as a human race. And you will succeed in your cooperation as a human race. Yes, this is a common grace for all people, folks. This is a common grace. People who are far from God have enjoyment and success in cooperation. They do. This is a common grace to all people. You have to look no further than to see this past week's news, to see the response of cynicism and the response of hopelessness or the response of despair in regards to these things. People took note that in putting together his cabinet, President-elect Trump was meeting with Mitt Romney, and a big hubbub was made about the fact that Mitt Romney said some incredibly terrible things about Trump during the campaign. How on earth can they possibly do this? Well, because of the common grace of enjoying cooperating with one another in this world. Trust me, if he makes him his Secretary of State, there's going to be cooperation between them. He will represent that administration. It's amazing, but even two people who have said horrendous things about one another have the ability to cooperate. They do, because they have vested interests that are the same, and they will find commonalities of which to work with. Now, that's not necessarily spiritual. It's just truthful, common grace that we can live under. Finally, not only will we struggle and strive to make much of the soil, that we'll have to fight against thorns and thistles, but here's the thing that you need to see between the lines. The fact is, we're going to be able to eat the fruits of our labor. We're still going to be able to eat. We're still going to be able to enjoy what we produce. We are still going to produce things and take some joy in our work. Yes, it will cause sweat. Yes, it will cause a lot of striving and struggle, but we still get to do it. We still get to do it. Do you notice what he said to Adam and Eve? And by the way, this isn't just to the woman and to the man or meant to be gender specific. This is actually something that the whole human race was meant to take in as great news. And that is that in some sense, human beings are still going to be able to live out their creation image-bearing intent. And that is to multiply and to have dominion and to make much of the world for God's glory and others' good. We're still going to be able to do that to some degree or another. That's the common grace of having a commuted sentence, a sentence that did not directly send them to eternal death. And so, Adam, he's hearing this proclamation of judgment. And some of us might think, after calling Eve life-giver and hearing what he said about her before, might say, did we just hear the same judgment? No, you didn't, actually. What many of us hear are only the consequences. What Adam heard were the common graces. And you know what he understood about the common graces? The point of the common graces in this narrative? The common graces raised in this narrative were meant to raise the question, to open up the crack of the door, to show a sliver of light, to let you know light is coming. To let you know a Redeemer is coming. to let you know there will be one who won't just hold evil at bay. There is one who will crush evil in its finality. And all things sad and broken will be redeemed for good. And so the way of Adam, this is what hope looks like. This is what hope looks like. It's the kind of prayers that are heard that are the prayers of shalom, the prayers that pray for peace. That's what shalom is, peace or wholeness or wellness or a sense of restoredness. This is shalom. And to some degree or another, all prayers that believe the gospel are all, to some degree or another, shalom prayers. Praying for peace, praying for wholeness, praying for the redemption of all things. See, Adam and subsequent generations that followed in the way of him and Abel, they would offer prayers for a true hero redeemer. They would look to a hero redeemer that would someday come, one that will rescue us from the hostility and the enmity that we experience in this world. A prayer that knows he needs a rescuer and that he can't rescue himself, and that he doesn't rescue himself best by going onto the other sideline where it appears the other team is winning, but rather throwing his lot with a future hero redeemer that would win in totality. We also see one who sees the relational strife, but understands that crack, that sliver of cooperation and ability to still procreate, and that ability to still even engage in togetherness as a people shows us that there's a better togetherness. There's a better relational hope that can be had with new hearts and healed relationships. And so the prayer of hope, the prayer to be heard was one, restore us, heal us. Look through the early portion of your Bible, the Old Testament. How many prayers reflect this, the shalom of this? And how many of our prayers reflect this is that we focus on heal us, give us new hearts, give me new heart. Make my new part act as it really should and not as I have led it just astray today. New hearts in a healed relationship, a prayer of hope that is heard, is one that knows there's a better land, that knows the struggle and strife, even though we make momentary strides, even though we make momentary forward advances, it's all a mirage because it'll all be torn down. Mow my grass tomorrow, needs mowed again tomorrow. Do this today, tomorrow I'll need to redo it. Things unravel. Entropy reigns. So I need a better land. So I see that I'm going to have some successes. Are those successes meant to give me hope in my own efforts to somehow sustain successes forever? No. It's a crack in a door to remind me light is coming into the world that will make it possible for us to live in and enjoy a new land. It's an invitation to dream of and pray for the new heavens and new earth. That's the heart of hope that prays. The heart of Adam passed to Abel and subsequent others who have believed in days gone by. It's the legacy that many of us live under. Some of you have been living under the legacy of Cain, despairing and living under the sense of a cynical response. There is no prayer to be heard because prayer is futile. My actions are what count. And so you've scurried and done your best through this life. This is what Cain did, and this is why his offering was not held in regard, because he disbelieved that God would right the wrongs and make the change. That the ways we can succeed and still enjoy life in this world, the common graces of this world, were not meant to be telling us that you can make this permanent, but rather they were meant to tell us to look forward to the one who will make it permanent. I wonder what our prayers look like this year, whether our prayers are even something we engage in because they are futile. If you're in a time where you're just not praying, chances are you've given into despair and cynicism, and so your actions, your reactions are far more important than anything you could say to God, at least in your mind. Again, that's the way of Cain, friends. And it's a way that does not end well. So as we close, I just want us to respond to the Lord, believing what he has said, and knowing that as we celebrate this Advent season, he hears our prayers. Jesus coming into this world, light broke in, John tells us. It broke into this world. That is a cosmic postcard saying that all the good I promised in Genesis 3 is now coming true. And we are invited in this Advent as he has come toward us to now respond in faith and hope to him. If you've never done that, I encourage you to trust, put your hope and faith in him for the first time today. Let's pray.